Greetings and merry Yuletide intoxications, my rapturously malavisionary listeners, and welcome to this December 2015 Science News Update. I'm your host for this laughably ludicrous science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. Well, a bunch of you out in podcast land have heard my plight. Yes, I finally got some email this month, and I salute the kindness of Matt Parsonage, Peter Hogberg, Dale Moore, Melissa Goddard, and Julian Hayes. Even better, all of you guys sent in story ideas, which is very cool, and I thank you for all of them. And one of these days, I have to do a segment where I just talk about stories from listeners. However, there are so many amazing science news stories to tell you this month that I will address only one of your suggestions, and one that I considered pretty much the most amazing. Matt Parsonage asked an intriguing question about a topic that I frankly have missed entirely. Matt said in his email, quote, "I am sure you know about it already. There is a Dr. Ritter out there who says he has a broad-spectrum antiviral super serum. From my basic cellular biology knowledge, it seems like it could be the penicillin of the virus world. He says the research has gone into the valley of death. How could something so possibly important be brushed under the carpet? He doesn't seem too phased that this has happened. Maybe you could enlighten us, please? The Draco thingy basically hunts down a viral, infected cell in your body and causes cell death. It seems simple and effective, other than the problem of taking a dose for the common cold and not realizing you're infected with a myriad of other viruses and accidentally destroying half the cells in your body." Unquote. Wow, that's something. All right, I looked into it. And let me see if I can clarify this. Okay, so this Ritter guy is actually Dr. Todd Ryder of MIT's prestigious Lincoln Laboratory. So he's not really much of a crackpot. He works as part of the Panacea program, which stands for Pharmacological Augmentation of Nonspecific Antipathogen Cellular Enzymes and Activities. Ryder's research group has developed and demonstrated a novel broad-spectrum antiviral approach called Draco. Draco stands for double-stranded RNA-activated caspase oligomerizer. So Matt, you are absolutely right. Draco selectively induces apoptosis, that's cell suicide, in cells containing any viral double-stranded RNA, rapidly killing infected cells without harming uninfected cells. As a result, Draco should be effective against virtually all viruses, rapidly terminating a viral infection while minimizing the impact on the infected patient. In work reported in the journal PLOS ONE, Ryder reported that Draco was effective against 15 different viruses that his team has so far tested in cells. This includes cold viruses, also known as rhinoviruses, H1N1 influenza strains, adenoviruses, a stomach virus, also known as a reovirus, a poliovirus, dengue fever virus, and several members of the hemorrhagic fever family. Draco was also demonstrated to be non-toxic in 11 different cell types representing various species, that is, monkeys, humans, mice, as well as being harmless against organ types. They tested heart, and liver, and lung, and kidney. In addition, experiments demonstrated that Draco not only is non-toxic to mice, but can also save mice infected with a lethal dose of H1N1 influenza. Currently, the team is testing additional viruses in mice and beginning to get promising results with those as well. Ryder says that although more extensive testing is needed, quote, "Draco has the potential to revolutionize the treatment and prevention of virtually all viral diseases, including everything from the common cold to Ebola. Because the antiviral activity of Draco is so broad-spectrum, we hope it may even be useful against outbreaks of new or mutated viruses, such as the 2003 SARS outbreak," unquote. I guess that Draco is selective for virus-infected cells. Again, just as Matt said. One difference between viral-infected and healthy cells is made primarily by the length and type of RNA transcription within the cell. You see, most viruses produce long double-stranded RNA during transcription and replication. This indicates a sick cell. In contrast, uninfected animal cells generally produce double-stranded RNA no longer than about 24 base pairs during transcription. So there is a big difference between the two, and that's what's used for targeting. Cell death is induced by one of the last steps in the apoptosis pathway, in which complexes containing intracellular apoptosis signaling molecules all bind at the same time. These are called procaspases. A caspase is a protease that destroys proteins. Procaspases are the inactivated version of the caspase enzyme. The procaspases are activated into caspases when they're cleaved, and then they further activate additional caspases in a cascade of reactions. Once activated, they cleave a whole variety of proteins that are needed by the cell to keep it alive, and so they kill the cell. I must say, it's absolutely brilliant. I'm still not sure entirely that this will work in an animal bigger than a mouse, or in anything but tissue culture, but it is absolutely brilliant. I await the human trials. If it does work, then I suspect it will be fairly harmless to humans. Yeah, okay, it may end up killing a bunch of cells for viral infections that you didn't know you had, but unlike our bacterial microfauna, which are an important part of our microecosystem, there is nothing good that viruses do for us. They are simply molecular parasites, and that is the beginning and the end of it. Any cell infected by a virus is one that we are well rid of. I'm more worried about the targeting mechanism for Draco. We frankly still do not know enough molecular biology, especially the brain, to be certain that there are not cells out there making long-chain RNAs that are not absolutely needed for things like creating memory. Aren't those cells susceptible to Draco targeting? I can just imagine in the first human trials, we will discover that even though Draco cures the patient of all their viruses, they become brain-dead zombies, as a large proportion of their brain cells are apoptosed. Sorry, just a thought. All right, it's a dark thought, but it's a thought. Thanks for the email, Matt. I'm sure lots of people will appreciate the new nightmare we've lent them. Next story. The one thing I liked best about Star Trek The Next Generation was always the holodeck. I thought it was a great idea to create solid holograms. Absurd, yes, but great. It was always a hoot to see Picard or Worf doing some sort of martial arts workout on the holodeck. Star Trek Next Gen was not the only science fiction show to pick up this theme. The later seasons of Red Dwarf gave the virtual body of crewman Arnold Rimmer a hard light drive, which I laughed at, despite the fact that it was not actually one of the jokes on the show. I won't even mention Jim and the Holograms. Blah. Anyway, I guess the laugh is now on me. Yes, someone has created a hologram projector which allows you to actually touch and interact with the hologram. It's still pretty primitive, but that hard light hologram drive may be possible in the not-too-distant future. Dr. Yoichi Ochiai of Tsukuba University and his research group presented a paper on their work at the ACM meeting in August. Sorry, it's taken me a while to dig this one up. The presentation at the meeting was entitled, quote, "Fairy Lights in Femtoseconds, Aerial and Volumetric Graphics Rendered by Focused Femtosecond Laser Combined with Computational Holographic Fields," unquote. What does that mean? Well, using extraordinarily fast lasers, called femtosecond lasers, the researchers developed fairy lights. This is a system that can fire high-frequency laser pulses that last a millionth of a billionth of a second. The pulses respond to human touch so that when interrupted, the hologram's pixels can be manipulated in midair. Other researchers have apparently done this before, but the trick that Ochiai apparently has pulled off is that the lasers he uses do not burn anybody's hands. Previously, it was impractical because the process actually burned flesh. Ochiai believes this technology can be used for entertainment, medicine, and architecture. He says that the current state of light technology does not allow humans to proactively interact and feel light as matter, but the touchable hologram has the potential to change that. Ochiai says, quote, "You can't actually feel the videos or pictures, and although you can project a video, you can't interact with it by touching it. So if we can project an image in a three-dimensional form, and if you can touch it, then you can make something where you'll think that there actually is something there." He goes on to say, quote, "People's lives would change if we use a bigger laser in a bigger space where people can interact with it and see how it can be used in situations where three-dimensional communication is necessary, such as a construction site or in the medical field," unquote. So the biggest investor in the touchable holograms is presently Playboy Tokyo, who say they want to start a series of tea rooms where the waitresses will all be blonde, hard-light holograms who will cater to a salaryman's every beverage need. Really? Just kidding. No, Playboy Tokyo is not interested in this technology. But yes, listeners, we are living in the future. Well, where do we go from here? Holodecks and the cure for all viral infections. Aren't any other stories just going to be a letdown from here? Maybe, maybe not. How about creating wired-up electrical organisms? Is that not new and amazing? In the quest for tools that would offer finer control of plant physiology, a team led by Magnus Berggren from Linköping University in Sweden have created flexible circuits inside the stems and leaves of rosebud cuttings. The work published November 20th in the journal Science Advances may also lead to opportunities to harvest energy from the plant's natural biochemical processes, according to the report. Berggren formed the circuits using a conductive water-soluble polymer called 3,4-ethylene-dioxythiophene. The researchers dissolved it in water and then placed a cut rose into the container. The rose took up the polymer in its xylem along with water, where the polymer was then visible when the researchers peeled back the top layer of plant matter from the stem. This is kind of like those experiments you used to do in grade school, where you would take a white carnation and drop it into water that had green or blue or red dye in it, and then you would see that the dye moved up the xylem and into the flower. Similar to that, I guess. Berggren says, "There was a moment during the screening when my grad student showed us all these beautiful wires. When I saw those, I immediately understood it was possible to make electronic circuits inside the rose." Unquote. By attaching electronic probes to both ends of the wires, the researchers confirmed that the polymer structures could indeed conduct electricity along their lengths, and they used the wires to create a transistor. Berggren's team also used vacuum pressure to get leaves to take up a different polymer solution, creating a conductive network inside the plant tissue. The researchers could adjust the visible color of the resulting leaves by applying different voltages. Although this is all very cool, the actual application to living plants remains yet to be seen, although the authors are hopeful. Berggren says, quote, "Previously, we had no good tools for measuring the concentration of various molecules in living plants. Now we'll be able to influence the concentration of the various substances in the plant that regulate growth and development. Here I see great possibilities for learning more," unquote. So cool as it is, putting electrical circuits into a plant may be mostly a tool to help study plants and really not much more than that. Although, frankly, it sounds very cool to me because I may be able to use that one of these days. Okay, let me try to up the cool factor a bit, since we are finishing up the year here, okay? Next story may affect you directly, all right? This is amazing. How about an actual cure for the genetic disease of colorblindness? As I tell students in my medical genetics class, colorblindness affects more people than all other single-gene diseases combined. Yes, it is that common, and it's a mutation on the X chromosome. So any male out there who has disease can thank their mom for it. Colorblindness affects approximately 1 in 12 men and 1 in 200 women. The condition is caused by abnormal photopigments, the color-detecting molecules residing in the retina's cone cells. A defect in one of the genes responsible for making photopigments results in an individual not having the specialized cones that respond to blue, green, or red light. And that lack significantly alters the way that people experience the world. Now, doctors Maureen and Jay Knights of UC Berkeley University have cured colorblindness in primates. Over the years, the Knights Laboratory has developed a novel gene therapy that enabled them to add L-opsin into red-green colorblind primates who are missing the pigment gene that would allow them to see colors. They designed an adenoviral vector to carry the L-opsin gene along with transcriptional regulatory elements that would direct gene expression in green cones, but not in other retinal cell types. Jay Knights says, quote, "What we did was infect a subset of green cones with the virus carrying the red gene. That red gene turns on and replaces the photopigment in that subset of cones, and you now have three different kinds of cones, like you see in an animal with normal color vision. In so doing, we restored full color vision to the animals," unquote. To deliver the virus to monkeys, the Knights collaborated with talented eye surgeons who injected the solution containing the virus into precise locations underneath the retina. Okay, frankly, the thought of that kind of treatment makes me kind of shudder, and Jay's comments make me shudder more. Quote, "It's very delicate surgery, and it required three injections of the infusion over the whole back of the eye. It worked great, but it wasn't very practical. We've been working over the past 5 years with a tiny syringe with a very fine needle that could give a colorblind person a single shot in the eye in the doctor's office instead of in a surgical suite under general anesthesia." Cue the chorus of ewes. Let's see. Needle in the eye or color blindness? It's such a difficult choice. So now they have this fine needle and they can inject the virus directly into the retina quite easily and it cures the monkeys. Next up, the clinical trials. And if that works, this will be a major genetic disease which could become part of the past. The Knights hope to start clinical trials in the next year or two, as well as extend the therapy to treat other eye disorders. The next story from this month's Journal of Experimental Biology is not quite as impressive as curing a genetic disease, but still kind of cool. The devil's hole pupfish from the Mojave Desert is one of the rarest animals on Earth. The current wild population of the little fish is about 131 adults. And they are likely to be limited in their ability to grow their population naturally because they live in a dark cavern, which rather dramatically limits the amount of food that can grow there to support the fish. Dr. Frank Van Broekelen of the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, was curious to know how many pupfish the restricted ecosystem could actually sustain. However, before he could do the calculation, he needed to measure the scarce fish's metabolic rate. As the native devil hole pupfish population is too endangered to study directly, Van Broekelen measured the metabolic rate of a refuge population of fish that has been established in his laboratory as an insurance policy should the population ever be wiped out. But when he performed the measurement, he came across a very strange puzzle. He recorded the fish's oxygen consumption at temperatures ranging from 25 degrees Celsius to 38 degrees Celsius. And he found that they consumed oxygen at a pretty stable rate of about 300 microliters an hour when they came from a population that had been raised at 28 degrees Celsius. However, when he measured the oxygen consumption rate of fish raised at 33 degrees, that's the temperature in the Devil's Hole spring, something went wrong. The fish appeared to stop consuming oxygen. Van Broekelen said, quote, "My initial reaction was that there was a malfunction in the electrode, but after testing 295 animals, we had to concede that the phenomenon was real. The fish were somehow switching from aerobic metabolism to anaerobic metabolism," unquote. When I teach cell physiology, one of the topics is aerobic versus anaerobic metabolism. Aerobic metabolism is primarily used by cells, especially in animals, because it nets huge numbers of ATPs, large amounts of energy when sugar is broken down. anaerobic metabolism, which occurs when there's very little oxygen or no oxygen, is nowhere near as effective as aerobic metabolism. It yields only about 1/15 the amount of ATP per glucose molecule generated by aerobic metabolism, and it can only occur in small organisms. So why would the fish do this? Why switch to a system that gets you so little energy? Intrigued, Van Breukelen and his team tested whether the phenomenon was a result of the lab fish population breeding with another closely related species. It wasn't. The closely related species to the devil's hole pupfish acted in exactly the same way. They tested a whole series of hypotheses trying to explain what the phenomenon was and why it was working the way it worked, and all of them proved absolutely wrong. Until, Van Breukelen says, quote, "We were going nuts trying to figure out what triggers anaerobic metabolism in these fish. It finally occurred to them that maybe the fish were switching to anaerobic metabolism to avoid the toxic side effects of aerobic metabolism. What is the toxic side effect? Well, the main one is producing ethanol. They knew that the 33-degree acclimated fish naturally produced high levels of ethanol, 7 times more than the fish from the cooler water. Could the ethanol be switching off aerobic energy production and stalling oxygen consumption? How would they test this? Well, they decided to get the fish drunk. When the team added ethanol to the fish's water, even the fish that were adapted to cooler water temperatures switched to this, what they called paradoxical anaerobism. So, ta-da! The devil's hole pupfish switch off aerobic metabolism to avoid the toxic alcoholic side effects of an aerobic lifestyle, despite the fact that it comes at the expense of making way less energy. All right, last story of the night. Here is a question. Are male and female brains the same, or are they different? This has been argued back and forth for years, and I suspect it'll continue to be argued back and forth even long after the story that I'm going to talk to you about tonight. Some people would argue that there are absolute differences between the male and the female brain. Many of those are based on experience and stories and things like that. The authors of the next research that I'm going to tell you about would, well, frankly, they would disagree with that conclusion. Dr. Daphna Joel of Tel Aviv University has written a research paper this month in the Proceedings of the National Academy entitled Sex Beyond Genitalia, the Human Brain Mosaic. To test the theory that there are physical disparities between male and female brains, Joel and her colleagues looked for differences in brain scans taken from 1,400 people aged 13 to 85. The team looked for variations in the size of brain regions as well as the connections between them. In total, the group identified 29 brain regions that generally seem to be different sizes in self-identified males and females. These include the hippocampus, which is involved in memory, and the inferior frontal gyrus, which is thought to play a role in risk aversion. When Joel looked at each individual brain scan, she found that very few people had all of the brain features that they might expect to have based on their sex. Across the sample, only about 4% of the people examined had all male or all female brains, depending on the definition. Quote, "Most people are in the middle," unquote, says Joel. This means that, averaged across many people, sex differences in brain structure do exist, but an individual brain is likely to be just that, an individual, with a mix of features. Joel makes it quite clear in this statement. She says, quote, "There are not two types of brains," unquote. Although the team only looked at brain structure and not function, their findings suggest that we all lie along a continuum of what are traditionally viewed as male and female characteristics. The study is very helpful in providing biological support for something that lots of scientists have suspected for a long time, that brain gender is not binary. This is why my daughter can love dolls and dressing up in pretty bright clothes, but she loves just as much roughhousing with her brother and Star Wars lightsaber battles. Human brains are not necessarily biased in one direction or another. Being male or female is far more complex than what we have traditionally understood and accepted in the past. Joel says, quote, "Despite persisting stereotypes, statistics show that girls are no better or worse than boys at science and math. People get wedded to the idea that being male or female is highly predictive of having different attitudes or aptitudes or career choices. This study fights against the idea that these outcomes are based on biological differences as opposed to cultural expectations," unquote. Joel concludes with, quote, "I envision a future in which individuals are not so routinely classified based on gender alone. We separate girls and boys, men and women all the time. It's wrong, not just politically, but scientifically. Everyone is different," unquote. I guess that the hope is that Joel's findings can be used to help people better understand the non-binary nature of gender. Life is complicated and getting more complex all the time. Remember that even if you identify as male or female and your body matches, some people don't identify as either male or female at all. Others seem to feel their gender identity shift over time. And still others have gender dysphoria from an early age where their physical body and mental gender state don't match. Yes, Caitlin, we're talking about you. Because of this complexity, we need to start thinking a lot more carefully about how much weight we give to gender as a defining feature of a human being. Yes, gender becomes important when you're choosing a public toilet, but we have to ask ourselves when gender becomes entirely irrelevant to a question. Well, that's all for me for now. As always, take care. Keep those needles away from your eyeball unless you want to see what true colors Cyndi Lauper was talking about. Keep those pupfish in cool water to prevent drunken brawls. Be careful in defining your binaries, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.